Good morning, everyone. I'd appreciate it if you take your seats. My name is Judy Barcelow. I'm the director of the grant program here at U.S. Institute of Peace. And I'm delighted to welcome you today to what I know is going to be a fascinating set of discussions. We're very proud to have been part of this project through a couple of small grants that we made in support of it. We know that research is never easy to conduct, but collaborative inquiry, especially when carried out across ethnic and national divides on a subject as contentious as the underlying causes and the tragic consequences of the wars in the former Yugoslavia, this is an enormous challenge. We are honored to have been able to help fund this project, as I said, in a modest way, placing our full confidence in Professor Charles Ingrau, who has done a truly inspiring job of pulling this project together in a way that we never anticipated. The project is all about historical narratives, and I have to tell you that the narrative about this project itself has changed since we first laid eyes on it. When Professor Ingrau first applied for grant funding in October 2001, he was talking about an initiative that involved some 50 scholars from North America, Western Europe, and Serbia. When I looked at his last grant report, I saw that the project has grown to some 250 scholars, five times the original number, drawn from 27 countries and five continents. And this truly is a testament to his grand vision for the project, his ability to sell that vision to others, his inspired coordination abilities, and his truly superior fundraising skills. Now, USIP has invested heavily in the Balkans over the course of nearly 20 years, and we've made something like 150 grants totaling over $5 million. These projects have varied considerably in type and focus. They've ranged from research projects like the ones that we're talking about today, educational projects that have reached millions of people, for example, through funding for a B-92 film on war crimes at the wartime military prison in Lora, Croatia, dozens of conflict resolution and interreligious dialogue workshops, and various training activities, including, for example, workshops for journalists and editors on how to cover war crimes trials. Most of these grants have been very modestly scaled, ranging from about $25,000 to $50,000. But these small amounts, we believe, have gone a long way in the region. Looking over all these projects, it's clear to me now that this project we're talking today is exactly the sort of project we want to be funding at this time. It's exactly right for the times in the Balkans now. Wrestling with contending historical narratives and examining how those narratives drive conflict, and then exploring bridging narratives, these are activities crucial to the restoration of long-term peace in the Balkans. Reconstruction there must proceed not only in physical and economic terms, but also in social and psychological terms, and these activities are at the core of that enterprise. Before I turn the microphone over to my colleagues here, I just want to tell you that in the fall, the grant program will be organizing a conference involving USIP grantees and others that will be focusing on the teaching of history in societies emerging from conflict. Among other issues, we'll be examining the relationship between the production of historical narratives by scholars and others, their translation into curricular materials at the high school level, and the role that educational systems play in reproducing historical narratives, sometimes for good and sometimes for ill. So we'll look forward to keeping you posted on that project. Congratulations again to all of those of you who have participated in this project. We're very, very pleased to have been associated with it.
Thank you, Judy. My name is Roger Potocki. I'm Senior Program Officer for Central and Eastern Europe at the National Endowment for Democracy. We're also involved in this project as one of the co-funders. I want to thank USIP for organizing this event and for helping support this project along with us. It's our honor to do it. The NED has been active in the Balkans since the late 80s. We spend roughly $3 million a year on democracy-building projects in the region. We consider history and reconciliation and understanding of the conflict that went on there vital to our program and to what the changes that the Balkans are currently undergoing. It's been an honor for us to help support this project. In my other life, I'm a historian. I don't claim to be an expert on the history of the Balkans, but I'm now an expert on history of managing common histories. This is the third one that NED has done, and as a result, I'm in awe of Dr. Ingrao, who's managed to pull this off. The last common history we funded took about 7 years and didn't attract quite nearly the audience that this one has. So I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Ingrao and just say that I really admire the work that he's done and the effort he's put into this project, and it's been a remarkable adventure.
Well, thank you both for your gracious comments. I do want to shift the focus a bit to not all 270 scholars whom we now have, and that changes weekly, but to the 20 team leaders without whom there would be no project, and to the perhaps 50 or 60 scholars among the 270 who have done original research, have done interviews, and have literally coursed around the Atlanta community gathering what information we've been able to assemble to date. But first, I'd like to go back to Europe and to Northern Ireland, actually, to begin my comments, because I want to place this in a broader context. In 1988, I was watching television, as I'm sure many of you were, witnessing the murder of two British soldiers who had driven in Belfast or perhaps Londonderry into a crowd of mourners mourning the death of four or five Roman Catholic citizens who had attended a funeral for four or five Roman Catholics who had been killed by a Protestant gunman as these British soldiers ran into this meeting. They were dragged out of the car through the windows, stripped nearly naked, and shot in the head. BBC recorded this because, of course, it was present for the funeral in the first place. I sent an email to a colleague of mine, and I said, you know, I'll be in England this spring for my sabbatical, and when we're together, I'm going to ask you, what's the solution to this problem? And my colleague Tim Blanning, who's at Cambridge University, and I met for the first time in January of 89 as events were taking place in Yugoslavia that would overshadow anything that had happened in Northern Ireland. And I sat down in his living room with our wives, and I said to him, okay, Tim, I'm here. What's the solution? A typically naive American. And he looked at me, and he said, that's just it, Charlie. There is no solution. Let me take you halfway around the globe to this weekend, as I even brought a clipping with me about the demonstrations in Beijing and elsewhere in China, about the unresolved narratives that separate the Japanese from the Chinese, which we're all familiar. The question is there a solution? Certainly there is no solution given the current priorities in the public policy sphere. Elected politicians in newly emerging democracies, and indeed in old democracies, oftentimes don't have the political courage to break with the mantra, with the dogma that is in school books and that is in the public sphere. Politicians need to be reelected, and so they cannot work against the current that they and their predecessors have created through media. At the same time, Western political leaders have tried to change the perception only at the top of the causative pyramid. Western political leaders will use their leverage, financial aid or whatever, in places like the successor states of the former Yugoslavia, or in Romania and Bulgaria and Albania and other countries that are multi-ethnic, and say, we would like you to appoint a Turkish minority minister. We would like the government of Macedonia to have three or four ethnic Albanian ministers. Changes at the top. If you want to have financial aid, we would like to see you make this available and have this language taught in the schools. These work in terms of getting rid of the symptoms, but they not only don't work at the base of the pyramid, where the electors, where the voters, where the people stand and continue to smolder in resentment, but it actually heightens resentment of the United States and EU countries who do this kind of top-down intervention. Scholars are different than the public policy sphere in one important sense. Government officials, whether it's we're talking about the State Department or elected officials, think in cycles of 2, 4, 6 years, and they are looking at immediate solutions to immediate problems. They don't look at the base of the pyramid. They look at the problems that during their stint, whether it's in the Congress or in the State Department or in other policymaking bodies, during their period of time at the helm, problems that can be solved there. They, as A.J.P. Taylor pointed out many years ago, they muddle through from crisis to crisis. That's how they are evaluated. That's how they are measured, succeeding or failing. Nobody looks at the grand picture. That's what scholars are supposed to do. And the scholars in this project have been looking at the causes of these seemingly intransigent problems, whether it's in China and Japan or Northern Ireland, but in particular for this project in the successor states of the former Yugoslavia. How we put this project together depended on meeting certain very important criteria as we were bringing together scholars whose nations are in such conflict and who remain divided and dead in the water in the region in their inability to bridge these gaps of perception and culture. We have insisted on impartiality, that scholars who've joined this project must be open to other forms of information that have been banned from the public sphere in one or more of these different republics. We have people from 27 countries, all of the entities of the former Yugoslavia, but they don't represent those countries. They represent scholarship and the commitment that scholars have to, among other things, impartiality, to the openness to new ideas. And so they may represent, they may come from one particular country, one particular space where they're aware of one narrative tradition, and we urge them to bring that to the table. But on that table will be the traditions, the evidence, the claims, the myths of all the other groups. And then we put them together and try to validate or invalidate what we have in front of us. A second feature besides impartiality is inclusiveness. The reason we have 270 people, not all of whom by any stretch of the imagination actively participate, is we do not want to exclude anybody from having access to what we're doing. Everybody has the equal right to at any time object, comment, suggest, criticize. On the research teams that we have that are from 11 different teams studying 11 different major controversies. We have mixed together various groups, and when somebody says, I want to be on the Hague Tribunal research team, or I want to be on the ethnic cleansing research team, we always say yes. If this person's CV comes through, we see that there is certainly a match in their interests and their qualifications. We don't want to say no to anybody, and hence 270 people. That explains this. We don't want to really exclude anybody or the information they might bring to us. The objectives have to be clearly defined. We are not writing a history of the former Yugoslavia. We are writing a narrative that brings together the narratives of different sides that have met head-on in controversy. So there will be nothing in our book and the other publications about the Dayton Peace Accords, because that has not generated controversy about how it came about. But there will be a great deal said about controversies that led to the Dayton Peace Accords. Fourthly, transparency. This project could not have taken place without email. 270 scholars, but really this project is 250 scholars who have email addresses. Because in being transparent, we constantly send emails out to all 250 scholars whenever a team report has come to the floor and needs to be discussed. Until that stage, the 10, 20, in some cases 33, 34 members of a research team correspond with each other. I don't know how much correspondence exists between teams because I'm usually not privy to that. But as I course through the 12,000 emails that I have in my various files on my computer, I can tell you that email is absolutely essential, and it provides the transparency where decisions are made in front of everybody. Sometimes this means that commentators will make comment anonymously, especially junior scholars, who are certainly a large number of the people in the project, who are intimidated by sending an email criticizing a team report written by a very senior, prominent scholar. But my associate editor, Tom Emmert, and I look through these, and we make the judgment whether we should send this out simply anonymously. And also, we sometimes do look at the character of the tenor of the comment, because we are not into confrontation when confrontation is gratuitous. Finally, scholarly integrity. I like to think that one of the biggest surprises in this project, the ways in which the different groups have gotten along, The ways in which, let's say, for example, Serbs and Croats have managed to work together, and most recently, in my recent experience, Albanians and Serbs have gotten together, is a reflection of the fact that the scholars in this project identify themselves as scholars, and they are committed to the methodology of scholarship. And so whereas it is possible in the region to talk to politicians, and they will privately tell you that they know what happened in Operation Storm, and they know about the massacres that took place in Kosovo, but cannot do so publicly, our feeling was that scholars wanting to reaffirm their integrity and their commitment to our science will want to put themselves on this common agenda, especially since we can provide one thing that politicians don't have, and that is safety in numbers, and something else that we have tenure. Politicians, it's easy for us to criticize them. They don't have the ready acceptance of their constituency. Yet at the same time, scholars are able to see things that maybe politicians either can't see or don't want to talk about publicly. That may be why, according to an article I read in December in the Washington Post, I think it's 89% of American academics voted one way in the November election, and a healthy majority of the rest of the country maybe voted the other way. So how do we get our message out, whether it's in the United States or East Asia or the British Isles, but in this particular case, the former Yugoslavia? The way we break through from simply the internal incestuous relationship of scholars who really know what happened, but who have heretofore confined themselves to sitting around a table and complaining about the ignorance of politicians and about the platitudes that we know are not true, and I must say I think about the United States as much as I think about the former Yugoslavia when I say this, we have gone to media and to political leaders. I've established a network of political leaders in all but two of the republics. We have not in Montenegro and Macedonia, but obviously our focus has been on other areas of the former Yugoslavia, other successor states. And we have nurtured a network of media that is represented by a group of 9 media liaisons. And I don't want to miss any cities here, in Ljubljana, in Zagreb, Novi Sad, Belgrade, Banja Luka, Sarajevo, Pristina, Podgorica, and Skopje. And we have 2 in Serbia. And I should say 2 in Belgrade. Now, these media liaisons are going to take these books that will gather in libraries, and we are publishing at least 3 books, one of which already appeared in December devoted to case studies. In the journal Nationalities Papers. But in addition to the books, we want to break through to the public sphere, where the majority of the people may have different opinions than what we academics know to be true, false, or unknown. And here's where our funders come in. I can't say enough about what USIP has done to get this project started. They are responsible for the organizational stage. When we went from a Serbian-Western dialogue, which I felt could be done without money, to a international, inter-ethnic initiative, really. As much as I'd like to take credit for the expansion of the project, I'd have to say that we took this direction because that's where the money was. Because without funding, this was going to be done on a shoestring, and it was going to be very difficult to manage. So I think we have to start with the organizational stage with the confidence that USIP gave us. And then the second stage, when the National Endowment for Democracy came forward with a grant that, I don't know if Roger was in the room when this decision was made, but on the face of it, this proposal, I am told, looked very weird to the people at NED. And Paul McCarthy, nonetheless, were you in the room at this time? Or yeah. As I understand it from third sources, which I cannot footnote here, indicated that I think we want to give this project a chance. Let's go ahead and do it. Without that NED money, we could not have paid for new research, not that we're ever going to finish that new research, but certainly a first round of research, even in secondary and published primary sources, but also a series of interviews. And the degree to which we've been able to generate new information, even though it is still just a fraction of what's out there, This is very important. Also, funding team leaders who, from the successor states, must look to forms of sources of income in order to justify doing extra time. Without the funding from NED, we never could have gone as far as we did, and I'm immensely grateful for them for bringing this project through the research stage. The third funder, which is very new, is the Balkan Trust of the German Marshall Fund, a combination of the Mott Foundation, USAID, and indeed the German government. And they have provided the money for the media stage, for the representational stage, which is media liaisons, academic liaisons in most all of the cities I just mentioned, who bring the academics from that particular republic or entity together with the media and the political leaders. One of the blessings of academe in Central Europe in general is the much closer contact they have with political leaders than we have in the United States. I sometimes get the feeling that American academics are looked down on by political leaders, perhaps in one particular part of the American political spectrum. In Europe, certainly in Central Europe, and maybe above all else in the successor states of the former Yugoslavia, it has been possible to meet with team leaders from the region who know the prime minister, who know the president, who know the foreign minister. And so developing a network here that can break through the wall that separates academics and what they think they know and the public sphere and the people who are at the base of the pyramid upon which everything must stand or fall. So what have we done in the last 4 years? Let me just say that thanks to the funding from USIP and NED, we've had meetings that began in Mirovic, in the SREM, in Serbia, Vojvodina, that was funded by local sources that brought together the Serbs and the Western scholars from both Europe and the United States and Canada. A second meeting that was funded by USIP, hosted by Jacques Klein and the United Nations. A third meeting that took place in Edmonton, Canada, funded by the Center for Austrian and Central European Studies. A fourth meeting in Budapest and at the same time in Skopje by a human rights agency in Skopje and by the German university, Andrássy University of Budapest. And now this fifth major meeting, of course, funded by NED and USIP. I can't say enough about all the people who provided the sustenance, not just for the organizational and research stage, but also for all these meetings. In fact, I don't know if Marty Slutzinger is in the audience here, but I think Marty's approach to this is something that we are very grateful for. When we were casting about for funds to bring in scholars, he said, if you have problems with this, let me know, and we can help bring people in. It's that kind of generosity that has made this project succeed to the extent that it has. I'm looking at the watch, and we are actually ahead of time. And I think that's important because we have 11 research teams, eight of which are represented here. And we want to leave as much time as we can for discussion. But I mentioned Jacques Klein, and I mentioned him for a reason, because at one time in talking to Jacques about this project, I said to him, and of course, as many of you know, he's a retired lieutenant general in the U.S. Air Force. And we looked at the funding, which for academics is a lot of money. For most of the rest of the world, the public sphere, it is not. And I said, you know, this whole project, the total cost of this project is less than the price of a nose cone on a single JDAM. And I would like to think that we can have an explosive impact nonetheless that will be far more effective and head us in the right direction. Thank you.
So we will move around.
Yes, and I don't have the program here except on my laptop, but the next session, which will be chaired by Don Hayes, USIP fellow and diplomat Don Hayes, and will include Gail Stokes, Drago Roksandic, from one of the teams, Independence and the Fate of Minorities, Maciej Klemenčić for the international community and the SRI belligerents, Darko Gavrilovic and I for safe areas, and Mila Bielaitz for the war in Croatia. And while we're setting up, let me say that there are 11 teams, and not all of them could be represented, but Team 1 and Team 2 have already issued their reports publicly. And there has been a tremendous amount of media coverage, especially in Croatia and Serbia, that you can access on the World Wide Web at the project website. And the first team, Kosovo under autonomy, is the second team, the dissolution of Yugoslavia. The third team just issued its final report at the end of March. And that third team report is represented here, Independence and the Fate of Minorities. Incidentally, colored copies of the finished reports are in the back room, and then other reports that are virtually finished or in various stages of preparation are also in the back of the room in I think, more limited copies. And you will see in these reports the stages of production. Many of these reports have gone through 6, 7, 8 drafts, as colleagues have commented and criticized and pointed out new things that must be looked into. And I should stress that none of these reports are final in the sense that as new information becomes available, we have to go back and add and adjust. I, as some of you know, I'm an 18th century Habsburg historian, and in the 18th century, we are still finding evidence that we're still writing about and still changing the way we look at that field. So you, I think, want to be aware of the fact that anything that is said, anything, any comments that are made, suggestions, whether from you in the audience or the 270 scholars or critics in the region, is say, you did not talk about this, we will look at it to the extent of our ability.